Hello, and welcome to another NABBW teleseminar on a topic we boomer want to know about related to our goal of getting our financial houses in order as we look toward retirement. This evening, we're talking about IRAs, individual retirement accounts. My name is Ann Holmes, and I'm your moderator and the boomer-in-chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, an organization dedicated to educating and empowering women at midlife. This call, like those that we do every month, is one of the ways we serve our membership. This evening, we are speaking with one of our favorite guest experts, Pamela J. Sams, CRPC, a chartered retirement planning consultant and NABBW's retirement planning associate. Tonight's topic, navigating the IRA minefield. Pam Sams is an expert in personal finance who always covers important information related to money and financial planning. She is president of Jackson Sams Financial Services, a financial planning and wealth management firm located in Herndon, Virginia, near the Dulles Corridor. Her firm's focus is helping women understand the importance of financial and retirement planning with a focus on the importance of placing our own needs first. That's why Pam begins her work with each client by making sure she understands each woman's goals and then working up an individualized retirement, or not necessarily retirement, but individualized financial plan. So thanks for joining us again tonight, Pam.
Thank you very much for having me again, Ann. So I think this is going to be a very interesting topic because a lot of times, you know, people accumulate money in IRAs, and they're a little tricky when it comes to taking money out of those vehicles. So I think we'll have a good topic to talk about tonight.
Excellent. I remember when the traditional IRAs, individual retirement accounts, were first invented. I think it was probably in the mid-70s. I remember that the company I worked for at that time didn't have any kind of retirement savings program. So having an IRA seemed like a good idea, and I invested in one a year for several years. But about 10 years after I did that, I became divorced and shortly after that in dire need of money. So despite everybody's advice, I cashed in my IRAs, and of course everyone who was telling me not to do it was right. There's a huge penalty, as you know, but I didn't really understand how it works for early withdrawal. But I figured that I was innocent and naive enough to think, well, I have hardly any income, so how could my penalty be that bad? Of course,
yeah.
That was me being naive. But the thing is, as I've done research since you told me what we were going to be talking about, I've realized that I was not and am not the only person ever to be confused by the rules for the IRA withdrawals. In fact, I've read, and you can probably tell us a lot more about this, that the rules are not only not simple and basic, but they actually fill volumes of the tax code. So assuming that that's true, I guess I would like to start at the bottom line for our financial discussion, which is essentially, making our money work for us as hard as possible. So regarding IRAs, why do you call the IRA a minefield? Let's start with that.
Great. But before I do address that one, because it is definitely a minefield because there's so many, you know, things going on. But the reality, you know, now more than ever is that, you know, when it comes to retirement planning, there's just really so many risks that are simply out of our control, such as inflation, things that go on with the market volatility, how long you're going to live, of course, longevity, Social Security, and Medicare legislative changes to those programs. But there are some things that you can control, and one of them being planning properly when it comes to your retirement plans, and one of them being, you know, your IRA. Besides your, you know, your 401k that you, if you're working with your employer, most people do, you know, rollovers into IRAs. That's besides your home, probably a large accumulation of your assets are in IRAs. And if you don't really do it properly, you know, it can cost you a lot. So the minefield, you know, I think of it in terms of a minefield as a good description of it because there are so many stories throughout my career as well, and still picking stories up about individuals just, quote unquote, blowing up their IRAs because they've done it wrong and didn't understand the rules. And like you said, there's so many things that are embedded into the tax code that people aren't aware of. It's not as simple as let me accumulate money, and then when I need it, I need to take it out. So it's not a simple process like most people need to do. So avoiding mistakes is something that you can control, and it's really, in most cases, the most important way to manage some of the things that you can't control. So I call it the minefield only because there's so many hidden things that are in the tax code and so many ways of doing it wrong if you're not familiar with all of the rules that you can really blow up your IRA, and you don't want to do that.
Right. Excellent. Well, since I alluded to the fact that my quick reading indicates that there's tons of rules, and you alluded to the rules a little bit in your prior answer there, let's talk a little bit about what they call the IRA rule book.
Yeah, and it's not really, you know, the rule book per se. It's not something called the IRA rule book. The IRA mm-hmm. rule book is IRS publication 590. So people call that publication, IRS publication 590, the IRA rule book. And what it is that it's over, last time I saw, over 100 pages long, and it's updated annually. And let's be honest, it's really not one of those fun reads that you're going to mm-hmm. sit down and read publication 590 as a book club book or something like that. But it's really important because the information that's contained in there is really critically important, because those rules really impact almost every transaction that's going to be made with your IRAs.
Mm-hmm.
So without having a pretty good understanding or knowledge of publication 590 as it regulates to your IRAs, you need to make sure you understand at least the majority of what needs to happen in terms of your transactions with IRAs. And that's where the mistakes come into play, because we kind of assume that it's just as simple as putting money in and taking money out, and it's not as simple as, you know, as people think it is.
All right. So your financial planner or your accountant, if your accountant is especially knowledgeable with taxation issues, apparently you and those people are having to read this 100 plus pages every year to figure out what has changed from one year to the next.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we're sitting down and reading all 100 pages. We get updates and highlights of the what I get personally, and I know it's probably most financial planners get, is what they call the IRA updates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically legislative changes that have occurred, tax changes that have occurred as it relates to the rules with IRAs. So being knowledgeable mm-hmm. about things as they come down the pike annually is basically what most accountants and financial advisors need to be aware of, along with, of course, the other transaction-based rules that occur when people go to take money out of IRAs or do rollovers
mm-hmm.
From plans to IRAs. Those are basically the mainstays, and then you get updates, annual updates on, you know, different, what they call, what the IRS call letter rulings. So let's say somebody challenged a particular rule with they quote unquote, they may have thought they blew up the IRA, then they go and they appeal, so to speak, to the IRS,
mm-hmm.
and then the IRS may rule in their favor, then that may become an update in the rule book according to that judgment that they made with that particular individual. That may become part of the rule book. Say, okay, this
mm-hmm.
occurred. Now, you know, we know that's okay to do regardless of, you know, somebody have thought it was a mistake before, but the IRS let that one slide, and it may become part of the IRS rule book or updates. So we get those letter rulings as well of people who have challenged the IRS in regards to their IRAs. And then, you know, we know what not to do in the future or what some things that can happen.
So IRAs. It almost sounds like it's a situation kind of like when we watch a show on TV where your attorneys are talking and they're saying, well, you know, there was a precedent set with, you know, mm-hmm. and they talk about some legal case and based on that particular case and the ruling how the Supreme Court or the, you know, the lower court ruled in that, you know, I think that we can make the case. You're having to do that same sort of analysis. Is that
correct?
What
yeah.
comes
so
from,
when some,
from
yeah.
the letter rulings?
So, yep, from the letter rulings, you get mm-hmm. an opportunity to take a look at some changes that may occur with IRS decisions. So that's one of the things that you have to keep up to date as well. And so that's, you know, the thing that I'm saying is that a lot of individuals don't get these updates, mm-hmm. IRA updates. They are incorporated eventually, you know, into, you know, the rule book, quote unquote, publication 590. But if you don't go back and kind of reread or know the latest updates on those, you can get caught on, oh, it used to be this way, but now it's something else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't want to, you know, kind of get your wires crossed on making decisions based on old things that used to be in the rule book, but now they've been updated and now, you know, something different has occurred and it may not pertain to your particular personal situation.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there's a lot more that I have questions to ask about that, but I mm-hmm. would like to keep moving forward here, and maybe I can come circle back to that little bit toward the end. So let's talk a little bit here about what are some of the common mistakes that people make with IRAs, considering the fact that they are probably not working, you know, quite often they might be working on their own to make these decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, and the most of the times that I see them in three particular areas that I see, you know, that most of the mistakes occur. IRA rollovers, which we'll talk about in more detail. Each one of these we'll talk about in more detail. IRA rollovers, withdrawal income options, because, you know, just as you were explaining before, taking your money out prior to certain ages will get you in trouble mm-hmm. as well. So knowing when to withdraw and how to withdraw the income out of IRAs, and then also beneficiary planning, you know, what happens to your IRA if you leave it to someone, if you didn't use it in your lifetime. There's also ways to transfer IRAs to people in the most efficient manner without blowing it up or having the beneficiary pay huge tax penalties that they didn't have to if they'd known the rules on that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of IRAs, rollovers, just to make sure that, you know, listeners are familiar with what a rollover is, it's really the transfer of the retirement assets from one retirement plan to another retirement plan. So what you're looking at is either you left a job and you went to another job, you can transfer the employer-sponsored retirement plan that you had from that one to another 401k, or you can transfer the monies from that 401k plan to your own individual retirement account or IRA to be eligible to withdraw from those plans. You have to have certain triggering events. So if you left an employer and you want to roll it over to your individual IRA, that's basically separation of service, and you're allowed to do that. So you can transfer it there. You can't do it if you're currently still working at the same job and you have a 401k, and then you go to your employer and say, I want to do a rollover and take my money and put it into an IRA. You haven't separated from service or done any of the triggering, what they call triggering events, so you can't do that. Mm-hmm. A rollover can also be transfer of assets to your own IRA to another IRA, and also, you know, without having the triggering event. So if you went from, let's say, a traditional to a Roth, you know, there may be some tax implications there, but you can go from one to the other. But mm-hmm. where people run into, you know, issues is that they kind of overlook their personal circumstances before electing which rollover to take. And what I mean there is really, you know, the separation of service part of it is that you can take the money that you had when you were at that employer and then transferred to your IRA. But you don't want to take what they call an indirect versus a direct rollover. And the indirect rollover is where you take receipt of the money, and then you mm-hmm. have 60 days to put it into an IRA. So mm-hmm. they will just send you a check, and then you put it into your own IRA. So you never want to take receipt of the funds because, one, if you're under 59 and a half, that becomes a 10% withdrawal penalty that they have mm-hmm. to – the old employer has to hold 10% – has to hold, number one, 20% for IRS purposes, and you may run into a 10% tax penalty if you don't put it back within 60 days. They give you a 60-day mm-hmm. window to put it into what they call a qualifying retirement plan or IRA. If you do what they call a direct rollover, what you're doing is basically saying, I opened my own IRA, for example, let's say Fidelity. I left one employer. I opened the Fidelity IRA. I will contact my institution, my 401k, and they will send Fidelity IRA directly without me receiving any funds in hand directly to that new custodian or new institution. So mm-hmm. it's basically what they call a direct rollover where you're not taking any receipt of the funds. It's just going from one to the other, and there's no taxable that's not a taxable event. If you do an indirect one, like I explained before, and you take receipt of the funds and that check is made out to you, number one, if you're under 59 and a half, you have a 10% withdrawal penalty. And then number two, the employer is required by IRS law to withhold 20% of that and then send you the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that you're out of almost pretty much 30% of the assets just mm-hmm. by not doing a direct transfer, which is as simple as filling out a set of paperwork from your employer to the new IRA and just a simple signature saying transfer the money directly so I don't have to have receipt of it. Mm-hmm. What happens as well during that time period, if you don't get it back within 60 days into another retirement plan, the IRS assumes you have taken it as a distribution, and then they're going to tax you on the distribution as well. Mm-hmm. So not only have you had 20% withheld from your employer, possibly 10% early withdrawal if you're under 59 and a half, and now if you don't get it back, you know, and within 60 days, then they're going to assume you took a distribution, but then you have to pay tax on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So that can be really costly if you don't do your rollovers correctly. And that's why I said you run into a lot of the mistakes occur because people say, well, I left my one employer. I want to go ahead and just transfer it over to my own IRA. There are definitely ways to do that in the most efficient manner without doing it incorrectly. So that's one of the mistakes I see a lot. It's really paying unnecessary tax penalties because you didn't complete the paperwork properly or knew how to do a rollover properly.
Okay, excellent. Now,
any questions on that? I know that was a lot of information, so I just want to make sure if you had any clarifying statements in there, if you needed any more information there.
No. I think that I'm following it. Is there anyone listening to the call that has any questions? Okay, I guess we can move on, Pam.
Okay, awesome. So the next one would be withdrawal of income. And that's what, you know, we explained, you know, a little bit about that in the rollover section is that you have what they call the 10% federal tax pre-59 and a half withdrawals. So what happens is that retirement money is retirement money. So they assume that you really shouldn't be touching this money before mm-hmm. you're 60. At least, mm-hmm. you know, retirement, within the retirement age, they basically say 59 and a half or 60. So anything prior to that without a qualify, what they call qualifying event. So the 10% early withdrawal penalty prior to 59 and a half, you don't want to take monies out unless you absolutely have to. I know we, you had explained before that you, you know, you had went through a divorce, you needed assets, you needed to get your hands on money. So, you know, you kind of go where you need, where the assets are and where you need them. It's not ideal, you know, to take monies out of your IRA if you don't need them. But in an emergency, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But the 10% early withdrawal penalty will basically, you know, wipe out a pretty good amount of your assets. So you don't want to have to do that if you don't have to. The other, in terms of withdrawing income, I know we've probably talked about it on several phone calls before, is the failure, one of the mistakes is the failure to manage the 70 and a half distributions. And those are the required minimum distributions that the IRS basically tells you you need to start taking at 70. Because your monies are pre-taxed money, the IRS eventually is going to need to start taking money from you out of these, or want to start taking tax out of it. So they tell you you need to start taking money out of your IRAs at 70 and a half. And if you don't take the monies out accordingly per IRS rules, and it's an actuarial table that they use, based on, you know, longevity. So at 70, it'll be a percentage of what is in your IRA. And then each year, it's a different calculation that they come up with what you have to take out of your IRA when you reach 70 and a half. So if you don't take it out, let's say you didn't know about the 70 and a half rule, or you took one out later than you should have, the IRS actually penalizes you up to 50% of what you did not take out. So it's a very hefty penalty if you don't take your RMDs or manage them appropriately. That's why as you start getting closer to retirement, it's probably best to try to consolidate IRAs, because, you know, if you have an IRA at Fidelity, if you have one at Vanguard, you still have money all around, different ones. The IRS just basically takes a composite of all of the IRA money that you need to, that you have, and they calculate that RMD based on the value of a composite of all of them. So if you miss one, and that can well happen if you have several that are out there, what happens is that you go, oh, I didn't know I had this other one. Still, you know, the IRS will say, well, you should have taken this out because this is the value of your account. You know, sorry, you know, that you lost track of one of your IRAs. You weren't, you're sure. But I've seen, you know, back to kind of those single, you know, letter rulings, I've seen where, you know, people can go and say, oh, hey, you know, I had one out there. It was a straggler. I didn't know about it. And, you know, basically the IRS, okay, you know, we'll kind of give you a mulligan on that and you'll be okay. So it occurs, but, you know, you don't want to fall into that situation where something happens where you don't have a composite of all of your IRA money. So that's why I said as you get closer to retirement, you want to try to wrangle all of these things in. I see it a lot of times is that even, you know, people in their 40s and 50s who have had several jobs over the years, they just kind of leave 401ks behind and they just never do anything with them. So I've seen people with, you know, six or seven of these things just out, you know, over the course of their career, just hanging out and not doing anything with them. So you really have to make sure you start identifying all of the retirement plans that you do have access to, because this particular withdrawal, when you start taking out the 70 and a half, it really comes into play with all of the retirement plans that you have that are outstanding. That's how the IRS will calculate your RMD, which is your required minimum distribution. And basically tell you this is how much you need to take out. And you don't even have to take it out of all of them. You can take them out of, one or two, but they're going to come up with a number based on all of them together. So you can take it out of one, you can take it a little bit out of each, you know, so it really just kind of depends on what you need there.
Well,
but that's one of the areas.
Mm-hmm. From the little amount of reading that I did to try to get a little bit up to speed on this before the call, I got the idea that this is a really significant situation. What I read, and I'm a novice, so you can listen to what I think I read and tell me if I'm if I'm wrong or not. But what I thought I read is that if you don't take out the required minimum distribution, the amount the government rule allows that you'll be taxed at your regular rate plus a 50% penalty rate for the amount you didn't take out. And so the article that I read said that with poor planning in conjunction with your Social Security payments, that would mean that each new dollar of IRA withdrawal turns into $1.85 of taxable income. So if that is actually true, that is a real huge penalty.
It's huge, and that's what I'm saying. A lot of times people are get caught with this particular one. Yeah, I see this mistake more than often than not because, you know, unless you are kind of up on the rules or working with a professional or your institution who has your accounts need to start telling you, hey, you know, prior to the year that you turned 70 and a half or you're about to turn 70 and a half, you need to start taking money out of these accounts. If you're not, you know, aware of that, you can run into some, you know, pretty, you know, serious issues with not managing them properly. That's why I said, you know, the huge mistake besides the rollover that the rollovers that I see is people not managing their RMDs appropriately. One of the things.
If you have to take the money out, what if you don't want the money? So what do you advise people to do with it if they are required to make a withdrawal?
And that's the thing that I get a lot. It's like, hey, I really don't need this, you know, money, but they're going to give it to me anyway. They're just going to start pushing money to me. So if you don't need it, you know, how will you reinvest it? You know, buy what they call, you know, some people buy life insurance with it, and it's basically not the life insurance in terms of the death benefit, but as an investment. So you can buy, you know, life insurance with it. Some people gift it to a loved one or a trust to set up for future generations. Some people actually, I've seen, donate their RMDs to charity, you know, to, you know, if they're not going to need it, they, you know, they may put it, give it to charity. Really just, you know, understand how it all fits in your overall retirement income and estate plan. So there's maybe ways to either put it in trust, donate it, gift it, you know, things like that. But those are some of the things that I've seen people do with their RMDs. It's just really simply either reinvest it in something else or, you know, do other things, estate planning related things that they can do with them.
But probably not reinvest it into a new IRA.
No, not into a new IRA. No, they won't let you. They won't let you do that one.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do it. You know, and you know, maybe just some simple type of investments that don't have the IRA and that umbrella over it.
Okay.
But yeah, you want to put it someplace else if you don't need it.
All right. Excellent. So, I interrupted you a bit. Have we covered everything on withdrawing income?
Withdrawing income. Withdrawing income. We've covered the 10% and a half. The 10% with the pre 59 and a half. The RMDs. Also another one when it comes to that. And a lot of it may apply to some people, it may not. That's, you know, it's not a big one. But some people who, when they retire prior to 59 and a half, they can alleviate themselves from the 10% if they retire, let's say 55, the IRS allows between 55 and 59 and a half, if your employer allows you to as well, do what they call a systematic, equal systematic periodic payment. So for like 4 years, as long as you can show where you're getting a check in the same amount each year or each, you know, month, however they're going to divide it, you can basically eliminate the 10%. They'll say, hey, they're actually retired, but they technically would not have access to the to that IRA or 401k prior to 59 and a half, but it's a stipulation where in their let's say the 401k what they call summary description will allow what they call SEPPs, then you can basically say, then it has, and this is a formal agreement that you have with your employer that you go and fill out paperwork that you're going to do an SEPP. You're going to receive those funds on an annual basis, and you don't have to pay the 10% withdrawal penalty.
Okay.
Yep. So that's a good one to know, so you don't get yourself into that 10% penalty. If you, you know, a lot of times people say, well, I really want to retire early, but I got this 59 and pre 59 and a half thing hanging over my head, and I need assets before then. How can I do it? That's a way to get access to funds as well as eliminate the 10% penalty.
All right. Now, the third group of common mistakes you mentioned was beneficiary planning mistakes.
Yeah, beneficiary planning mistakes is really huge because you can really blow it up your IRA if you don't do it appropriately. And one of them is really if you overlook kind of the death benefit options that are available in IRAs. And it's a little counterintuitive because people kind of think of beneficiary planning as afterthought because you're not here really, so you don't really care about what's going to happen with the money. But, you know, you've accumulated these assets over the years. You want to make sure your loved ones or whoever is going to inherit your IRA to do the best that they can with it. So you do have to plan on leaving assets. If you're going to leave it to a spouse or family member, you really need to know what the rules are prior to as well and have a discussion with them as well, but, because a lot of times is that the people who inherit your IRA are unaware of these death benefit distribution options as well, and that there are very, critical tax ramifications of certain options that you really want to make sure that you stay away from if possible. And one of them, the most common one that I see beneficiaries do because they need money, you know, money right away, you know, they'll say, okay, you know, such and such a passed away. I inherited their IRA. It's a big sum of money. Now I have access to, I want to have access to these assets immediately. They'll take a lump sum. And then what happens in a lump sum is that that money becomes taxable all at once. The IRS says, okay, you're going to take it, but now you got to pay the tax hit on it. And that can be a very hefty tax hit. Or what I see as well is that they elect not to do that, but if they don't take the taxes, they can also have what they call the five-year option. So you basically need to take distributions out over a five-year period. And then that's how you would get paid, and then you have to pay taxes on that each year as well. So either both of them are pretty hefty tax implications if you don't do them appropriately. One, taking a lump sum, which is, you know, very costly, and then the other with you have to, you know, distribute all of the assets within a five-year period, you're still paying a lot of tax on that money over a five-year period. What most people, and what I suggest with most people, is what we call a stretch IRA. And a stretch IRA is that you're basically inheriting the IRA, and then technically it becomes yours, and it's the RMDs are calculated on the person who inherited lifespan. So you can take a little bit out at a time and not pay the big tax penalty. So you're basically, in essence, stretching out the tax liabilities, and you're getting incremental assets out of those out of the plan as well, without getting, you know, really big hits. The only, and so, you know, what they call a non-spousal beneficiary. So let's say your son or your daughter inherited mm-hmm. your IRA. They would have to start taking these required minimum distributions as well out of the IRA, but they can stretch it because it's based on their lifespan and not yours.
Okay.
So they don't
Excellent.
Have to take out those higher benefit amounts. I mean, those higher RMDs, it's calculated on their lifespan. So if your son or daughter is 40 or 45, then, mm-hmm. you know, the RMDs are calculated on that versus, you know, let's say 70 or 75.
Excellent.
From there,
good
so you get
right.
that. A spouse has a couple of options where they could basically take the IRA as their own, same situation, you know, it would be in their RMD calculations, or they can also stretch it out, and they don't, and they can also choose if they're prior to 70 and a half, they can choose to delay their RMD. So they don't, they're not required to start taking distributions out right away as a spouse.
Okay.
The only ones that have to start taking it out at, with inherited IRAs are not what they call non-spousal beneficiaries. So
mm-hmm.
you need to start taking money out. And that's what I see a lot of times is that the rules for the inherited IRAs are not really disclosed to, you know, unless you're working with an accountant or a financial professional, that
mm-hmm.
you need to start taking it out. So I actually met with a client probably, you know, 3 years ago, and I believe she probably had, her father had passed away. She had inherited his IRA. It was probably 3 years that went by before she actually came to me that she should have taken RMDs out of it, and she had
mm-hmm.
not. So we did. We went to the IRS, and that wasn't actually a single letter ruling on it, but we were able to get, I believe, at least one of those years eliminated from there. But that's what happens a lot of times is that some non-spousal beneficiaries will receive these monies and not knowing that you need to make a start taking distributions out, because it's really counterintuitive, because if you receive an IRA, you figure, you know, you have 70 and a half, there's kind of the same rules that
mm-hmm.
apply to the IRA prior, but it's not, it's quite different. The RMDs are required for inherited IRAs for people who are non-spousal
okay.
on those. So that's, you know, one of the areas that I see people get into trouble with, not taking it and or not stretching out the IRA death
mm-hmm.
benefit as well, because, you know, when people get a hold of assets, you know, they want them right away, or, you know, they see these, you know, big dollar signs and they just want to start getting money out of it without properly doing planning and saying, number one, I don't want to take a lump sum, and then also making sure you don't, you know, have to do that 5-year option. But this is all planning that you could do prior to, you know, to passing away. And have this conversation with people that you have listed as beneficiaries on, you know, what you would like to see happen, and, you know, explain to them some of these rules that, you know, I've accumulated these assets over my lifetime. I would like to not see you blow it up if you receive this, and some ways to really work through taking it in the most efficient manner without
mm-hmm.
getting into some of those heavy tax ramifications that can occur from not doing, you know, the inheriting it and not doing the proper things with it. But,
okay.
you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you have to kind of trust that that person will do the right thing with it. You can only
mm-hmm.
explain to them the rules that are required or they should do it, but you know how it is. You know, people will do what they're going to do when they get the assets anyway, but you want to make sure that, you know, they're not paying Uncle Sam more than they have to if they don't need to.
Right. Now, is the beneficiary always, does it always need to be a person, or could you name it to be an estate, or say not just your estate or your, you know, so that it would go somehow to your spouse, but what if you wanted to leave it to your church or something like that? Is that a really messy thing?
You can, I think charities are okay, because you can set up what they call, you know, charitable trusts, which are better. Just know if you do an individual, if you do an entity versus an individual, you're basically killing the stretch. So you're not going to be able to do the stretch from there. But, you know, there's ways to do, you know, what they call the charitable trust, as a, well, basically set up a charitable trust, and then the IRA is the trust is the beneficiary of the IRA. So, and then the tax implications are a little different with those particular entities versus if it was an individual. But it does kill the stretch if you have a trust as a beneficiary.
So it's probably better to have a person as a beneficiary is what you're
it's probably best if you want the stretch benefit. If you don't have, you know, I see that occurring is that if you didn't have any children, or if you didn't have a spouse or anything like that, and your main beneficiary is charities or things like that, that's where I see you know, IRAs being left to charities or charitable trust and then paid out that way versus individuals. And that's, like I say, usually with beneficiaries that, well, people who don't have either, you know, spouses left or children that they, you know, leave to charity. But more than likely, it's probably best to do individuals if you want them to stretch, because then if you stretch it, then you can use it for your lifetime, then you can transfer it to your children, and then you can transfer it to their grandchildren, and you can stretch this thing as long as possible if there's money still in it. So, you know, that's kind of the benefit of having the stretch option. But if you do it into a non-individual, like an entity, then that basically kills the stretch from there.
Okay. Are there any other areas of beneficiary planning that we should be talking about?
That those are the main ones in terms of beneficiaries. We talked about the spousal beneficiaries. They have a little bit leeway on how they elect to do their inherited IRA. They can roll it into their own. They can keep it separate as an IRA, and then they can also delay the RMDs. The non-spousal beneficiaries is where I see most people make the mistakes, is that you can't roll it into your own IRA, because then that also kills the stretch, and then it also may cause some taxable event as well, because you're well, what you're doing is basically taking it, putting it into your own, and then that has some tax ramifications, and then also you can't do the stretch, and you have to start taking RMDs. So that's one of the areas, like I said, is that a lot of people get into trouble with that. They're not familiar with all of the rules of non-spousal beneficiaries when it comes to the IRAs.
Okay. Now, if we've covered that pretty well, it sounds like we have, let's talk a little bit about are there ways that we can plan to avoid making these IRA mistakes that you've talked about?
Yeah, there are definitely ways. I mean, I think most people can read Publication 590. Right?
Yes, but without that, let's say without that.
Without sitting there on a good Saturday afternoon and reading Publication 590, really, you know, the opportunity to, you know, kind of look at avoiding making these mistakes is before you engage in any IRA transactions, is ask yourself three important questions. Number one is, what are my personal circumstances? You know, that kind of gets back to how the rollover situation. How do I take the rollover? What are my, you know, am I going to still need to have access to loans? Because a lot of people take loans from their 401k, you know, so if you want to have loan options, but you can't take loans from IRAs, then it may be best to just, if you take your 401k instead of put into an IRA, maybe roll it into, or maybe, yeah, maybe roll it into the new employer plan if you still want some of these options like loans and things like that. So always make sure you evaluate your own personal circumstances. Also, you know, your personal needs and what you are going to need. Looking at prior planning on how are you going to get resources if you need monies before 59 and a half without making sure you don't pay the 10% withdrawal plan penalty. So using maybe the SEPP, if that's available to you, to have access to your IRA or 401k prior to 59 and a half. So just doing, you know, kind of a personal needs analysis of what you need for your retirement plan. And then also what are your personal concerns? And what you're looking at there is really avoiding some of the beneficiary options as well. Because a lot of times what some of the concerns are is that how do I leave money to my estate properly? What do I need to do now? What kind of conversations do I need to have with my beneficiaries? So what you need to look at to avoid these mistakes, and of course, you know, the key is becoming educated in this area, you know, like, you know, teleseminars like this, your professional, if you have your accountant or your financial advisor, if you have access to one, knowing all of the rules that are available to you prior to making any IRA transactions, because, you know, once you make them, you know, they're irrevocable. So you don't want to make a mistake and then go to your professional and say, I did this, because there's ways to get around that prior to making that decision. So you always want to keep all of your professionals in the loop before you make any IRA transactions, because, you know, like I said, a lot of those rules will come back and haunt you later if you don't do it appropriately. And then you don't want to fall into, you know, a mistake that could have been avoided if you had got consultation prior or knew the rules prior to actually making that decision. And then, you know, really just gathering all of your beneficiary information and becoming familiar with that and having the conversation with all of your beneficiaries as you start doing your retirement plan as well, and making sure all of your beneficiaries are up to date, because a lot of times I see as you start collecting your various retirement plans and start looking at where income is going to come into retirement, some people go back and hadn't changed beneficiaries since they started plans, and they their old spouse could still be on there, their mother who passed away years ago could still be on there. You know, making sure all of your beneficiaries are up to date is the most important thing. And then those people that you do choose to put on as beneficiaries, let them know what's going on with the IRA rules as well and what you would like to see happen to your assets in the event that you do pass away, and let them know some of these beneficiary death benefit options that are available to them. And let them, you know, they're, like I said, they're going to choose which one is best for them anyway, but really let them know that there are some heavy penalties. That, you know, if you do it this way, you can have $1 million. If you do it this way, you may have $500,000. Which way do you want to go with it? And letting them know up front there's going to be some heavy penalties if you don't do it right. So those are really some of the areas that I would like, you know, that I wanted to emphasize in terms of how to avoid mistakes, is really becoming educated in this area. That's why I thought this would be a very important phone call. You know, as people start preparing for retirement, like I said, it can be a really big minefield of blowing things up if you don't know how to do things appropriately. So getting this education is really key.
Excellent. Well, at this point, I am going to open the line so any of our guests can ask questions. I know that there is one of our audience who has been sending in questions to me, but unfortunately she seems to have mislaid the mic, so she doesn't feel that she can ask. So she sent them in to me, and I'll read them. But meanwhile, I'm pushing the button so it's interactive, and then I'll. Her name is Sandra, and I'll go tell you what she's saying here.
Okay.
The first thing she said is there, this was 41 minutes ago she posted this, so I don't know if we've answered it or not, but she says, is there a way to avoid the second taxation on IRA withdrawals that they force you to take at the age of 69 and a half or 70, she says. And then she says, what is the exact age when they force you to take the withdrawals on an IRA? I think we've covered that, but is there a way not to be forced to take IRA withdrawals?
She says, go ahead.
Well, this might make a difference. She says, I forgot to mention that I am disabled with chronic pain and have been newly diagnosed with a disability of emphysema in the last month. I don't want to be forced to take IRA withdrawals if I don't need them, and I'm 68 years old now.
I have not seen anything in the rules that really negates the 70 and a half rule. If I, you know, run into any IRA updates based on, you know, because they're always coming out with new things, you know, just recently they came out with what they call ABLE, which is the account benefit for, it's kind of like a 529, but for people who have disabilities. That may be something that has different rules as it relates to distributions. So if I do run into anything that pertains to that, you know, just have Sandra follow up with me via email, and I can, you know, respond to her accordingly. But I haven't seen anything that negates that 70 and a half rule as it stands in Publication 590 right now.
Okay. And then we've got another question that's having to do with what can we do about improper titling? Say if a beneficiary other than the surviving spouse rolls a decedent's IRA into their own IRA, then, as you said, that rollover will be treated as excess contribution. And this person is saying, so that makes it subject to additional penalties and tax. And is there a way that I can avoid this?
You always want, if you inherit an IRA, do not transfer it into your own. It is proper titling that is key when it comes to the inherited. So the person who passed away always has to be on the named IRA. So it would read such and such a, for the benefit of the person who passed away, inherited IRA, and then the institution. So that person is always has to be in the title of that named beneficiary in order to be treated as an inherited IRA. Once it's in, transferred into your own IRA, it becomes lost and it becomes your IRA, and all of the rules or all the bets are off when it comes to that. So you do need to make sure when you inherit an IRA that the institution that it is at or you're transferring it to, that it's titled properly as an inherited IRA for the benefit of and that person who had passed away.
Okay.
So that, because that will signify that it is an inherited IRA and it should be treated on the rules based on an inherited IRA and not your own.
Excellent. I'm glad we covered that. Okay, those are the only questions that people have sent in to me, so I'm now going to say, remind people listening that I have the call now set up and interactive, so anybody can talk. All you have to do is speak, and we will hear you. If you have any questions, we would love to hear from you. Well, I guess, Pam, that we've... given people so much information,
they have to digest all the information. But definitely some very good questions that came through the chat, because those are, like I said, the areas that I see the most mistakes being made are not taking distributions and then also the inherited non-spousal IRA. Those are huge when it comes to that retirement minefield on people not doing it properly with that. So I definitely appreciate those questions as well.
Good. Well, since we don't have any other questions, I think that we can end the call. And, of course, I want to tell you, Pam, that as usual, you've done a wonderful job with coming up with these great questions about IRAs. And I only have one other question, and that is, do you recommend IRAs as a vehicle for people to use, or do you think that there should be other vehicles that we would look at instead?
I think the IRA is definitely a good vehicle. It's a, you know, it's become a kind of a repository for older, you know, retirement plans. You know, once you leave an employer, you can transfer it there. You know, so it has its benefits as well. It's just really knowing all of the rules that are available under that, you know, the IRS regulations based on the IRS publication 590 that you do. You know, at least have some form of knowledge in that area or have a professional or a financial advisor or an accountant that can walk you through that before you take any distributions or do anything with your IRA. But it is definitely a still a good vehicle to save for retirement. And, you know, like I said, you know, it's one of the key areas that people, you know, once they leave their employers, you know, a repository for your retirement plan, and then start, you know, really devising a retirement income strategy based on it. It's just making sure you do it in the most efficient manner as possible.
Okay. Well, I would have to tell you that as a non-financial professional, I think that I don't want to read 100 pages of 590 every year. I think I would personally say that, you know, I would leave that up to my financial professionals and say that that – I wouldn't trust that I would understand and interpret it properly. And, you know, I think I'm a fairly smart person, but the interpretation I would be a little bit worried about. So,
But, you know, if you want to make it at your next book club meeting, if you want to make it to Publication 590 required reading, then, you know, let everybody know, you know, all the former women, let them know.
Right.
This is what you need to read at your next book club meeting.
Okay. If you ever decide to have that as your book club, let me know. I don't know if anybody will show up for that club. All right. No offense, but I mean, it just doesn't sound like it's a fun read. It sounds like it's a good thing that we should, you know, have an expert that can help us with, but I don't think.
Yes, exactly.
Right. All right. Well, as usual, sorry for teasing you about that, but it's, as usual, it's been great talking with you, Pam.
Thank you very much, my guest,
and for the great discussion. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap up this call?
No, I think that's it. You know, I just really want to emphasize, you know, and I explain to, you know, people that I meet all the time is that, you know, this is quite different than our grandparents' retirement. It's so many things that can go wrong. It's so complex, you know, when it comes, you know, it's just not, you know, you walk out the door, you get the gold watch and you get your pension and everything's great. So, you know, phone calls like this about the IRA minefield, we talked about Social Security, you know, a variety of different topics as it relates to retirement planning, because it's gotten to be such a complex situation. And I don't want people to really, you know, have to step into these minefields without, you know, having the proper tools that are available to them. So, you know, if there are people who didn't want to speak up or, you know, had calls afterwards, you know, Ann's going to give my information. But this is a huge area where, like I said, I see a lot of people mess this up. And so that's what I really want to emphasize is that even after this call, do some research on your own if you don't want to, you know, dive into Publication 590. Just look up, you know, IRA distributions or how do I take money out of my IRAs or things like that. Just really become educated in the topic so you make sure you avoid the mistakes that we talked about tonight.
Excellent. And thank you very much for that, Pam. And you are correct. I am going to tell people, I want to thank everyone who's been listening, Sandra and those other people that may have been inundated with information and didn't know exactly what more to ask. Earlier, Pam, I had been talking to Sandra, and she said, this is a fascinating topic I need to know more about, but I never know what to ask. So I was really excited that she did ask some questions, but I realized based on what she said that there might be other people listening that are like her where they just really aren't sure what to ask. So let me say to those listeners that if you have any questions after the call, like Pam said, feel free to email them to Pam. You can reach her at pamela@jacksonsams.com. That's JACKSONSAMS.com. Or you can go to her website, which is www.jacksonsams.com. And she has tons of information. Pam has tons of information on her website, free information on a variety of financial topics. I'm sure there's some IRA and IRS information on the site. So people that are listening, please do go take a look at what Pam's got posted there. It's wonderful information. And then lastly, I'll just say before I close the call, if you'd like to know anything more about the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, you can find us in a number of places online. We have a website at nabbw.com. We have a forum, and that's at boomerwomenspeak.com, and a Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/NABBW. So those are all places that you can reach us. Especially, I would love to hear from anyone who has further types of financial concerns that they would like to suggest for Pam and I to discuss at a future call. We would love to find out what things that you would like to talk about. Other than that, I'm just going to say thank you again to Pam and thank you to our listeners. Thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight, and good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.